This is Series 3 of Brave New Girl podcast, and I'm Lou Hamilton, author and illustrator of Brave New Girl, How to Be Fearless, and I welcome you to the stories of real-life Brave New Girls who are creatives, founders, campaigners, health practitioners, and thought leaders who are making a positive impact in the world. This week's guest is Sarah Ferris, a creator, host, and producer of the top-ranking podcast series Conning the Con. Born out of the embers of her sister Emma's horrific experience of being targeted in a romantic scam. And so began the journey to create a podcast that aims to educate and prevent others from falling prey to con artists in their many shape-shifting guises. Welcome, Sarah, to Brave New Girl podcast. Hi, Sarah. How's it going?
It's so lovely to be here on this very hot, hot, hot summery day, Lou.
Yeah, finally, we've got the sunshine and for more than one day, which is really great.
Oh, long may it last. It's very British of us to talk about the weather.
Yeah.
Clearly, I've acclimatised to my British surroundings.
Yeah, you've come over to the other side.
Exactly.
But then I guess in New Zealand, you have lots of different weathers. Is it a topic of conversation?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I think my parents-in-law still just start every conversation with the temperature, and my dad tells me the temperature in his house as his starting point. And that's generally about, you know, 50 degrees higher than it should be in his lounge, because he's got the fire going and it's probably still summer. So yeah, definitely. I think it's in countries where you have quite a lot of seasons that weather tends to be the topic, but enough about that.
So, well, the other thing that we're kind of all talking about still all this time on is the pandemic. And I'd like to find out a bit about the podcast, which is like now a top ranking crime podcast. And you had started it before the pandemic, hadn't you? But it was really during the pandemic that it really took off. So do you want to just give a little introduction to what it is and what it's about?
Sure. So, I fell into the whole podcasting thing in quite a weird way. I have been a true crime podcast listener and TV watcher forever. Like, I completely loved it, binged it, consumed pretty much everything. But then what happened was, I think it must have been, was it 2018, my younger sister swiped right on a guy she met on Tinder, and she dated him for 6 months. And, you know, it was a really normal relationship in terms of he brought his mother over to stay with her. There was layers to the relationship. I'm going to preface that by saying there was also a lot of red flags. So what ended up happening was the day after she transferred $300,000 into his bank account, she discovered his real identity. And, you know, the wheels just sort of came off then. But the crucial thing is that at that moment, he had no idea that she'd discovered his real identity. So at that moment, we hit record and we didn't know what we were going to do with the footage at the time. Initially, my sister Emma hit record as almost like a letter to the police, like a safety letter. If anything happens to me, this is what's going down. And then it kind of just, it started to unfold in such a crazy, crazy way that we were like, I feel like we're living in a Netflix series. We need to record everything. And that's what we did. And that footage sat there from 2019 till the pandemic hit. And we sort of swayed back and forward. What are we going to do with this? And I was thinking to myself, well, I think Emma thought initially she was like, oh, you know, maybe a documentary, a TV show. And I was like, I don't think I can do that, but I can probably, you know, work out how to do a podcast. So there was a roadcaster competition that came up, and I think it was around the beginning of the pandemic. And that was when it sort of really solidified that we had something, because we put a 2-minute entry into that, and it got top in the UK at that time. And I thought, right, this is it. We're either going to do it or not do it. And we had a lot of conversations around, is this the right thing to do? It's really scary. And what drove us forward is one, because I think if there was only one of us in this story, then it wouldn't have been made into a podcast, because fear would have stopped us halfway. But whoever was scared of sharing the story at that moment, the other one was like, no, this is the right thing. People need to know this information. This is going to help people. And then, you know, a month later, it would swing the other way. And the other person would be like, yes, this is the thing to do. And the other one would be fearful. So it kept driving us on. And that went on until the pandemic and the Roadcaster competition. But what I should say also is the piece of information that Emma got when she discovered that he was a con man from the fraud department at the bank and the police was the best chance of her getting her money back was to carry on the pretense of a relationship with him, which if you can imagine, you've just found out you're sort of like in bed with the enemy. And then you're thinking, I've got to carry this on to get the money back. So there's a very, very dramatic sort of climax. I think it's around episode 4 where it comes to a head and she manages to get quite a substantial amount of money back, but she should have got an Oscar for her performance that day in the bank. And it was really terrifying. And I'm on the other side of the world, just not knowing what's happening. It was very, very scary. And then as the story unfolded after that moment, everything happened via text or email. He never contacted her or tried to get face to face. He tried, but unsuccessfully. So the relationship became this very much digital relationship, but still, you know, a relationship because there was enough to keep him in the game. He still had $100,000 of her money at that stage. So he was still, you know, I've got skin in the game and I can still possibly get that extra money back out of her. He knew it was sitting there. So that was his incentive to keep on going. And that's when he upped the ante. He actually wrote his autobiography to convince Emma that his whole story was so complicated and this is why he was like he was, and it included the craziest stories. I'm not going to give too many spoilers away, but it's very much, I think he thought he was James Bond, but he was very much Johnny English, probably would be the way to put it.
Really terrifying, as you say. It does get to that sort of point where she's still trying to keep the pretense going and he is obviously still trying to con her. So hence the name Conning the Con, which I think is a brilliant title for the podcast. And it does kind of keep you gripped from episode to episode as the whole thing develops. And I'd like to sort of go into it a bit more in a bit without obviously giving too much away. But let's sort of get some context on you and your sister. And, you know, you grew up in New Zealand. Can you paint us a picture of what life was like growing up together?
Well, I mean, I should say we weren't just the two of us. So I grew up in the very, very bottom of New Zealand in a place called Invercargill. That's where I was born. And there's literally not a lot to do there. In fact, I think Mick Jagger went there on a concert once and I think in the 70s and kind of went, who booked this? And called it the a-hole of the world. And, you know, there wasn't a lot to do, and probably because of that, I am one of six children. So maybe if we'd lived somewhere with a bit more excitement, I'd have a smaller family. But thankfully, I lived there, and I've got five wonderful siblings that I absolutely adore. And we were really lucky because we lived very close to a place called Queenstown, which is the adventure capital of New Zealand, and some would say the world, is where bungee jumping started. It's a beautiful lake. It's the idyllic picture of what you would imagine New Zealand to be. So that's where we spent all our holidays. And it was really magic. You know, we were roaming in the forests and skiing in the winter and water skiing in the summer. It is everything you imagine. It is a beautiful, beautiful way to grow up, which obviously my kids remind me every day since they're living in London. But, you know, they're not roughing it, to be fair. When we were about 16, both my parents are in education. My dad was a high school principal, head teacher, I think you'd call it over here, and my mother was a music teacher, and he ended up getting a job in another town, a bigger town further up the South Island called Dunedin, and we moved there when I was 16. And I think at that stage sort of two things happened that was quite sort of formative. I locked eyes on a guy in my class named Gareth, and I thought, oh, he's a curly-haired fox. And we sort of dated for 6 months and then didn't talk the entire time as you do at that age. And I ended up marrying him about, years and years later, which was pretty unheard of to marry someone you meet that young these days instead of meeting them online. So that was, you know, one nice thing that happened. And the other thing that was kind of formative was I started to volunteer with a charity called Edmund Rice Camps, and that was working with disadvantaged youths and running camps for, like, holiday camps for them, where they would get the experience to just have adventures and have a safe place to come with lots of sort of, you know, late teen, early 20s leaders, as it sounds. It does sound like a cult. It wasn't. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, that gave me a real sort of, I knew that I wanted to work with youth, and people were always going to be part of that. So I then went to university and I was going to study classics, but I pivoted because of the Eddie Rice camps and ended up doing social work. So that's what my degree was in. Yeah, I think that took me up to now. I think, I hope that answers your question. Well, not up to now. I'm not a social worker. There's a lot happened in between.
So you sort of found a passion, didn't you, and studied around that. And then with work, when you left university, how did you follow that passion through?
Well, it's not a great ending to my passion, I can tell you that. So that lasted all of 6 months when I graduated, because I went and worked for what was called the Children and Young Persons, and I almost got murdered twice in 6 months. Yeah. So, you know, it's a really under-resourced situation, and my job was being tasked with basically protecting a very vulnerable but also very dangerous teenage girl who was about twice my size, twice my height at the time. And she was very aggressive. And we didn't even have cell phones at that time. You know, it wasn't even any mechanisms of safety around it. And so basically I was like her tracker. I would take her places and, you know, try and keep her safe and basically the community safe around her. But, you know, she had a lot of mental illness as well. And I remember one time we couldn't get into the family group home where she lived, which was essentially like a foster home, which happened to be right beside the Mongrel Mob headquarters, which is a very notorious gang in New Zealand. And we couldn't get in, and she got really wound up, and she actually grabbed me by the throat and had me dangling, my feet were dangling off the ground. And I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to get out of this? And I'm thinking in my head, well, I'm going to yell to the Mongrel Mob and see how that works out. And I thought, maybe there's another option. I'm just going to try and talk her down.
Did the Mongrel Mob come to the rescue?
No, because I thought that might have been the worst of the two options I had. So I just sort of, like, you know, talked her down so she could put me down. But so I would return home from work after these days at work to my husband and my flatmates at the time, and they go, hey, Sarah, how's your day today? I'm like, well, have I got a tale for you? You know, and so over that time, my husband was like going, this is getting a bit dangerous, you know, I'm not. And I'm like, no, this is where my passion is. I'm making a difference. But then there was an explosion of reasons why I couldn't carry on working there. And we'd come back from a museum trip, which was like you just wished you were wearing a badge, because she was crawling over the top of like barriers to try and get into like, you know, exhibitions and stuff. And you're just like, people are looking at you like, you need to control your friend. I'm like, hey, mate, I'm on the clock here. This is above my pay grade right now. I cannot stop this. Anyway, so we're coming back from that museum experience, which had been an event in itself. And then we get in the car in my old bunged up, you know, like $500 car, which is all you can afford when you're a student and, you know, then you're working as a social worker. So I'm like, sounds like a sewing machine going down the motorway, and she gets very wound up at me about something, probably the fact that the radio doesn't work, because it wouldn't have, and she starts actually punching me while I'm driving.
No.
Yeah, and to the point that I'm like going, oh my God, what am I going to do? She pulls the handbrake up in the middle of the motorway and my car spins out. And unbelievably, it was the middle of the day in the capital city. And thankfully, there was no cars that are like close enough around me. And it's New Zealand, so we ain't got that many cars on the motorways. It's no M25. But so at that stage, I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And my heart's racing and I'm thinking, I've just escaped death, but I'm still getting punched here. So we're going to have to look at some options. So I pull the car over to the side of the road and I'm like, think, right, okay, you're just going to have to get out of the car just for a moment. I need to just, this is not safe for either of us right now. So she gets out of the car, jumps the barrier and heads down to the railway tracks. And I'm like going, oh my God, I've just created, I should have just taken the punches and just kept driving. But it was so bad. And I remember just like going, right, I'm going to have to get out and track her, thinking, you know, and you're looking around going, seriously, why is there nobody around me right now? This is nuts. I get down and I'm like tracking her down, but far enough away. And I can see she's walking along the train tracks. And I'm like going, oh my God, this is so bad. And the New Zealand Rail guys just happen to drive past and they go, madam, you cannot be on the railway tracks. And I'm like, do I look like the kind of person that hangs out on railway tracks? Give me your phone immediately. And so I rang the police and, you know, this particular person had, you know, phone book sizes of files at the police station. So as soon as the phone call was made, I think about maybe four cop cars came from either end of the motorway and whooped in on us. And yeah, and she was then locked down after that. And, you know, it was a really sad situation because there was nowhere for her in the system. She didn't fit into a place that was safe. So it was really sad. And it ended my career as a social worker because, well, I went home that day from work and everyone was like, that is it. It's intervention for you. Your Mother Teresa Act is over. Get yourself a real job. And so I did. I ended up working in sales, which I hated with a passion. And then we moved to London for a bit. So, yeah, that was my story.
I'm always interested how our passions sort of can go by the wayside, but only to sort of resurface in kind of other ways.
So true.
Your passion for crime podcasts and for helping others and using that sort of ability to suss out what a problem is and help people through it, that sort of came to the fore again with this podcast. So I'd like you to kind of tell me more about what happened with Emma, because you said that she handed over, was it $300,000? Mm-hmm. And that was actually because they were sort of going into business. So it wasn't like suddenly, you know, she was going out with this guy for 6 months and he was like, well, I need some money, give it to me.
Exactly.
It was the subtlety of his kind of seduction of her into his world was gradual, wasn't it? So can you talk a little bit more about how that sort of came about and how painful it was for you being the other side of the world as you started to realize that this isn't looking, you know, your radar for weird people and dangerous people was obviously sort of
Who knows if I have one after that. Well, I think the word that springs to mind when you talk about that is the word grooming. So Emma was groomed for 6 months by this person, and she was groomed in a way that you and I would be in a relationship. Basically, it was a normal relationship to the outside, you know, to her eyes. From the outside, there were red flags. And because I was in London, I wasn't getting those red flags every day. But we talked often, and when she did, she would say things to me and I'd be like, huh. So initially, when she talked about him, He came across as this, what we call the unicorn. I said, Emma, he sounds way too good to be true. You know, entrepreneur, into all of these things. He was sporty. He was an ex, you know, rugby player, ex national wakeboarder, restaurateur. The list went on and on and on. And I was like, oh my God, you know, tell me about it. First thing I'm going to do, Emma, is Google him. And she goes, oh, hang on. You can't Google him. And I went, oh, what? And she goes, yeah, he's taken all of his presents off social media because he had his ID hacked. And it cost him a lot of money to get it all off there. But that's what he did. And he had to do it because he had his ID hacked. And I went, Emma, that's a red flag anyway, right? That's a red flag. And she was like, no. Like, you know, he really did have his ID hacked. And what would happen is that when, you know, myself or anyone on the outside would come up with these like mirrors, basically holding up a mirror and saying, that doesn't sound right. She would then go back, and this is what happens. She would go back and have that conversation with Andrew, the con man, and he would put her mind at ease. what you can't understand unless you've ever been in a situation like this is that they're not normal people. These are people with psychopathic traits, and their ability to manipulate and to just sort of gaslight you and bend your way of thinking after grooming you for that long, it shouldn't be underestimated. It just shouldn't be. And I kept going through this relationship with her on these Skype calls and blah, 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 to the point that, you know, I met him online and I said, oh my God, Andrew, you sound too good to be true. I'm going to call you Dirty Andrew, because the Netflix series Dirty Andrew had just come out. And I was doing that just to test him, to see if there was any reaction. There's never a flicker with him, you know? So over those months before Emma did deposit the money, he'd been selling a restaurant in Australia where he lived, and Emma was in New Zealand. And, you know, he had all these grand plans. He was a finger in every pie you can think of. But actually, when we reflected back on it, what he was doing was giving himself enough options that she might actually be interested in. So Emma's got her own business. She's a really successful, unbelievably breath and stress coach, which were some tools in the toolbox to deal with what was to come, thankfully, because she's a trained physiotherapist. And she has her own business. So she'd also invested in property previously, and that was her intention that year, is that she was going to invest in a property. Now, when she first met Andrew, he was investing in a restaurant, in an alcohol company, and there wasn't talk of any property deals at that stage. But as soon as he heard that she was investing in property, all of a sudden that came into the picture. So it took a while for him to build up to, he did a lot of groundwork, I've purchased a property here. Even on like the first couple of dates, he would take her to property locations and say, this is the property I've just sold. This is the property I've just purchased. This is what's going to go on here. Here, have a look at the blueprints for this amazing plan that I've got going on. It was levels of detail. And, you know, if he'd kept that money, that's what he intended to do, probably with the money, is to buy that plot of land. However, he would have taken a lot of people down with it.
So she handed over the money, and then she realized that all wasn't as it seemed.
Yes. When the property idea came up, she was, I don't know you. This is not something I'm going to invest in. You and I might be done in a month. So that just percolated away. And then he just kept gently pushing. And then he came to her, and Emma thought, you know what? You know, this is a person that I've grown to love over 6 months. He seems perfect. He's great with my kids. Why wouldn't I invest? But if I'm going to, I'm going to dot all my I's, cross all my T's. So she went to her accountants. She went to her lawyer. She got it all signed up and seemingly bulletproof. But it's not bulletproof when you're dealing with a con man, because none of what he's got is true. And that was the real crux of it.
And then you realized together that this was a con, and you were the only way that she was going to be able to get some of her money back was by conning him. And so she did get the police involved and did manage to get a little bit of the money back initially. And then you needed to sort of get him back into the country because he'd fled, hadn't he?
Yes. So I think maybe a month and a bit maybe after she'd managed to get some of her money back, he was still paying interest on the loan, the official loan that he still had for the outstanding money. So she would be getting these drip feeding kind of interest rates. And if he defaulted on that, then she'd be able to like go, hey, you know, that would have triggered for him a bigger issue, because then it would have been exposed as a fraud, which we already knew it was a fraud, but he didn't know that we knew it was a fraud. So there was this whole kind of charade going on back and forward, and this pressure from Emma and me in the background and the family in the background saying, you need to get the rest of the money back. How are we going to up the ante? At this stage, we also went round the back of what he was doing and started to pull down some of the other cons that he had going on. So he was actually purchasing a restaurant in Queenstown, and you know, the owner had gone down 9 months of getting, you know, legals, and he was close to selling that restaurant to Andrew, which would have ended up falling on, somebody would have been left holding a baby at this stage. So it wasn't it needed to be taken down. So there was that, and then there was an alcohol company. So while Emma is having this kind of back and forth with them via text and email, we're kind of going around the back and talking to these people and going, hey, this guy's a con, you need to put an end to this, but please do not tell him where you got the information from. Don't let on that I know, basically, or Emma knows. So it was really like, honestly, I was living New Zealand time in the UK, which night is day. And, you know, we got to the point where Emma would just be like, I can't text him back. So she would text me the text that he'd sent, and I would write a message back to him in my best manipulative language that I could come up with. Like, you know, I'd craft it away at 2 a.m. in the bed and send it back to her. But I'd say things like, don't include this bit at the top, you know, obviously delete, send this on to Andrew for the bastard or something like that, or excuse my language, you know, delete that bit. And you know, once she actually forgot to take that bit off, and we were like, that's it, game over, we've screwed it up. But somehow we managed to twist the wording round and like let it slide. But I kind of feel like he must have, he knew something was up, because it was all going a bit crazy, and that's why he fled the country. So when he fled the country, we hadn't got to the point where we could get him arrested. So building that case for fraud takes a really long time, and it had happened at the same time as Christchurch had a very serious massacre. So all of the detectives were based in Christchurch that would normally be covering the Queenstown area where Emma was, as they rightly should be. So it kind of, it was a slow process. So the detective that we had, that Emma was working with, he was so amazing. And he managed to, after he'd fled the country, he said, look, we'll try and go through Interpol. So he was prodding that way. And he goes, but, you know, anything you can do to get him back in the country. So we were like thinking, okay, we've got to get him back in the country. At that stage, when he was out of the country, we managed to get a border alert so that he would be arrested if he did come back into the country. But anyway, I don't want to tell you too much more, but what I will say is some of the schemes that we came up with, Emma was like, I mean, I went dark. I was like, let's pretend you're pregnant. Let's, you know, I mean, she was like, you are nuts. There's no way that's happening. So, yeah, I think it ended, it all came down to an ultimatum in the end, and it was like, the carrot was big enough with the money, and we sort of crafted this message back saying, I've come to realize that the 6 months of our relationship is so much more important than money. And if you want to give it another chance, please come back. And let's just put the money to the side, and maybe in the future we can invest together. And that was enough of a carrot for any con man. So, but having said that, he was already in, you know, he still had more fingers and pies that whole time. He didn't miss a beat, And all of that was happening, and it's all in the podcast. So
it's really extraordinary. You know, it's very clever, the lengths that he went in conning, not just Emma, but all of these other people that you're sort of, these other stories that you're unraveling and reveal through the podcast. And you think, gosh, you know what? It's actually a talent that he has.
Yes.
But wouldn't it? Isn't it a shame that he didn't put that to being like a, above the board.
That's what all of us, because we did have his friends come out of the woodwork, and they all said if he put his talents to, you know, use, he'd make an amazing salesperson. He'd actually be a successful entrepreneur. The problem is that coupled with psychopathic traits just does not work. He's always looking for the utility in people. And that's why, I mean, we have a psychologist that we brought on board, Dr. Sophie Muir, through the podcast, because the whole idea of sharing the podcast was that the biggest question people would say to me when I'd tell them Emma's story pre-podcast was, how did she fall for that? How? And I'm like, dude, I asked the same question. And she asked the same question. She's a smart person. And I'm a smart person. I met him and I went into that conversation with him when I met him once and face-to-face when I was over at Christmas time. And, you know, I went into it calling him Dirty Andrew. I even like had like three chairs set up at the beach and one in front like an interrogation room. And I went, that's for you, Andrew, sit there. And, you know, I was making jokes about him being a drug runner to his face. You just pro, because those red flags were so real for me being removed from the situation. Once I met him and I was in that situation, he put all of those red flags to bed for me. And I left the situation thinking, he's just the soul of the earth, really entrepreneurial, clearly loves Emma, lovely guy. That's it. So that's why we decided to make the podcast, so that people can realize, yeah, it's not the gullible, it's not the naive, it's person with criminal intent going out with these amazing skill sets that psychopathic people have to be able to put on a psychopathic mask and mirror back to you what you want as a partner, to be the perfect partner, and that's what they give you back. And, you know, they have these incredible skills that, yeah, if they were harnessed and used for good, you know, lots of CEOs do have psychopathic traits as well, and harness it for the good. They could do something a lot better with it.
It's really interesting that you bring on a psychologist as part of the series, because it really helps to understand what's going on in his mind. Because otherwise you are kind of just like, how can this person do these things? And actually you really sort of with her describe, it's almost like the lying is, well, it's pathological, but it's like he almost can't help himself and he believes his own lies. And does she sort of explain more about what that is? And, you know, and for the rest of us, you know, in our businesses where we trust people, you meet people, you take people at face value. Sometimes your gut instinct is kind of wary. And so, you know, you may kind of follow that, but someone at his level, I mean, you know, most of us are going to miss that.
Yeah.
So what are the things that you came to realize and learned from the psychologist were things to look out for?
Yeah. Well, I think it's also important to say that the psychologist never met Andrew. So when we speak about the psychopathic traits on the podcast, we're talking about them in general. People that are serial con men or con women generally display these traits. And the things that we probably, that I took away, one of the biggest lessons was that gut feeling that you just spoke of is basically your body telling you something's not right, and you really do need to listen to that. But what happens is you have to give yourself space to do that. So what psychopaths and serial con men do and serial con women do is there's a lot of urgency. There's a lot of very close physical invasion of your space as well. So, you know, you feel kind of like, oh, the thing is, when you're in the moment with them, you feel so excited because they're generally very engaging. They're exciting people. They're charming. They can tell a good yarn, you know, and they'll be talking and talking and talking and, you know, everything will seem normal. And then they'll sandwich in some little piece of crazy and then onto the next story. So you do not have time often to go back and like circle back to that. And when you do, take the moment to go, hey, tell me about that. They're very good at circling away from it. So the one thing that the psychologist said that I thought was really easy to do is when you're in the situation with them and you had a conversation and you're excited and enthralled, when you walk away from that conversation, are you left feeling bamboozled, confused, unsure, not understanding what's just happened to you? Your logical brain is going, that wasn't right, but your experience that you've just had with them doesn't marry up. So, it, you know, that's that disconnect. Something's not right, but when you're in the presence of that person, it feels right still. So take the time to step away.
That's very interesting, because what you describe is the feeling of when you're being sold to, mm-hmm. like when people sell off the stage. Or, mm-hmm. you know, these kind of bamboozling emails that you get as someone is trying to sort of close a deal on something, or trying to get you to sign up for, I don't know, a course. Or, and I did get, I don't know, but it's not conned, because I sort of bought into, it was a very, very big, very expensive course, mm-hmm. that was sold off the stage. And I handed over a large amount of money. And so did lots of other people in that room. And it was this kind of sense of urgency. And if you don't get it now, you know, and if you don't do this thing, you know, your life is not going to be the thing that you've dreamt of. And so as you were speaking, I was thinking, my God, that is the same kind of wet. That's the same method, isn't it?
It is. That's a thing. It's actually everywhere. And it's that subtlety of manipulation. And, you know, sometimes people aren't really sure that they've had a crime committed against them, because you've gone in, like, for example, in a romance fraud, you've gone into it and willingly given that person the money. So where do you draw the line of it being, you know, somebody who's manipulated and committed a crime? I mean, obviously for Andrew, he was using a fake name and, you know, serial and completely fraudulent. But there are those people that walk that fine borderline of, I'm just going to make, you know, what's the utility that I can get out of people all the way through my life without crossing the line? And, you know, I know people that have you know, admitted, people that I've met on Clubhouse, in fact, who were previously convicted of crimes and have reformed, and they said, I would come out of a situation like jail and go to a strip bar where I would see vulnerable women and then I would use them for me. They would be my bread and butter for that next whatever. And you know, they're out there.
Andrew did end up in jail, didn't he, for a despicably short amount of time.
Indeed. And he'd only just come out, you know. He hadn't been long out of jail either, that's the thing. Emma and I, when we were making the podcast, were like, oh, God, you know, it's really intense. We're using his name and we're nice people. So for us, we were like, you know, I don't want to make his life unlivable. He might reform in jail. This, you know, he might be a good person in the end. This might be the jolt that he needs. Yeah. Week two of him coming out of jail, all of those were put to bed. Those worries that I had, not so worried anymore. Let's just say full circle there with Andrew.
And so did the psychologist say that there is anything that can help reform someone who has those traits?
Yeah, well, we have an episode at the end because I'm, you know, having that social work background, I was always really interested in how we protect our communities. And part of that protection is understanding what our justice system looks like. And if you've never been in it, like we hadn't been in that same kind of, you know, victim side for Emma, we didn't understand what that looked like in New Zealand. And actually, and it's a lot like everywhere else around the world, it's under-resourced. Those people with those white-collar crimes or the low security risks, they don't get access to the rehab that they need. You know, they can't even also have like that group therapy, because oftentimes if you're having group therapy, people are actually just swapping manipulation tactics. And so there's very much that you've got to be careful about how that's managed, and therefore it would be a one-on-one with a psychologist. Now, those hours are, you know, very small in the system. So I don't believe that the system allows for people like that to be reformed well. You would have to have a total aha moment and find the Lord or something, like an epiphany to some massive change that would come from within, because it's not coming externally from the system.
And so as parents, I wonder, is this something that you would recognise in your child?
Or, such a good question.
Or is it something that happens as a result of things that happen in their childhood, like serial things that they then start to create this almost like a survival or an armor for protecting themselves against sort of what they see as a world that isn't on their side?
Well, that's the exact question that I asked the psychologist, because that's, you know, for me, I'm kind of like, well, at what point could we have stopped this as a community? And the answer that she gave me was, you know, I said, how the parents must see this behaviour developing. And she said, well, generally with, and I'm paraphrasing here, and obviously this is psychology for dummies coming out of my mouth, but what I took away from her comments was that people that are developing psychopathic traits, they're not born with it. There's not a lot known about the genetic links between it and whether it has strong genetic links, but they're generally, you know, nobody's born evil. It is that mix of environment as well. And people that are closest are generally the people that cause those traits to develop in that child. So often like the neglect, the need to lie, the development of that pathological lying is because that served them a purpose at some point during their life. And whatever purpose that was, even when that purpose goes away, it's now just such a part of their DNA, really, which is tragic and awful. And it breaks my heart to think that there's people that are developing like that. But that is the sad reality of it. And as we spoke to his friends from childhood, that pattern of lying was there already, and they recognized it in him, but he was just Andrew, like good old Andrew, you know, come to school and he'd have a picture of a model that he'd cut out from like a news, like, you know, a magazine, like a glossy magazine, and tell everybody that that was his girlfriend. Now, they all knew that that wasn't true, but that was serving him a utility somehow. That made him feel like he was getting something out of that experience. And it wasn't enough for people to, the rest of his character traits, he was great fun, he was charming, you know, he was a good sportsman at that stage. All of that outweighed the fact that he was lying about this, you know, girlfriend. It wasn't worth the time. And I think seeing it that early in that development over those years, you can see he's almost honing his craft because we spoke to many of his ex-girlfriends over that time, and, you know, there was a lot of hurt and harm done to them as well.
So you've wrapped up the series, and I wonder sort of how Emma is, mm-hmm. and how she sort of coped and moves forward from something like this.
Yeah, so very early on, the whole motivation for doing the podcast was to make sure that it would just help one person, and that would be enough for us. If it just helped one person from being conned, or a teacher being able to recognise someone with psychopathic traits, then we would be like, right, that's it, job done. And, you know, I think the first episode went out and we had so many people reaching out to us saying, God, I'm in this situation and I can't speak out because of fear and I'm in danger. Thank you for sharing and making people aware. So, you know, that gave Emma and I that kind of fuel to go, right, we're doing the right thing. So, I mean, it's a very damaging, traumatic thing that's happened to Emma, but she's a real tough cookie and making lemons out of lemonade, really, and she's used it as a platform to be able to empower women going forward. She runs amazing breathwork courses, stress and trauma mindfulness, and amazing retreats where I just want to get on the plane to eat the food at. But, you know, so it's a long recovery, but she's putting the time into recovering it, and she's probably the strongest she's ever been, as she would say. Like, she's, you know, into jiu-jitsu. She's just, yeah, I mean, I think she's in a really great space. And, yeah, I'm amazingly proud of everything she's done since then and before that.
And for you, you've created this, you know, with her, this incredible series, and you're the sort of co-host and the producer. And so I kind of feel like you've fallen in love with making podcasts. Is there something else that you've got up your sleeve?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I started doing the podcast, it was basically me in my lounge where I am right now, working out on GarageBand how to edit, how to do it all, and how to make it into a podcast, how to upload it, do everything. So, you know, the whole production side was me just fumbling my way along. So now I feel a lot like slicker. So yeah, since then, a lot of things have happened. I met you on Clubhouse, Lou, as well, you know, and from Clubhouse, I ended up meeting some amazing people, and I ended up on Fireside, which is now a downloadable app as of yesterday. So it's out, open to the public.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which
yeah.
is exciting. And that's a space where creators can go and do live shows. And in that moment, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program, Catherine Schweit, and yeah, her and I connected and we did an interview. I interviewed her on Fireside, and we are now making a podcast called Stop the Killing, which is a series on how to basically, we look at an incident each week and really nut down the details of what we can learn going forward and how to protect people from these mass shooting incidents, and look at the end, we look at, you know, that behaviours of concern in the killer. So it's quite heavy, but that's one thing that I'm working on. But it's really important information, and Catherine's just an amazing woman, and full of such amazing information that I get to mine out of her. So I feel so privileged to have that opportunity. And along with that, at the same time as Emma was being conned, my parents-in-law got wound up in the largest Ponzi scheme that New Zealand had seen in a long time. 81 victims, $15 million gone by Barry Clue, a financial advisor who conned people for over 40 years. So I've just finished rounding up all the interviews with the victims, and I'm putting together a podcast series on that as well.
Wow.
So that's that. And I have a weekly show on Fireside called Conmunity, which is out of this whole kind of understanding of how do you fall for lies. And what we do on that show is we have, it's it's the light to the dark of Stop the Killing and The Clue and The Con in the Con. It's very much lets me have my lighter, you know, banter side of things. And on that show, we play a game of two truths and a lie, and basically we bring on a stranger to lie to us each week. And I have a panel of a rotating panel of people that come on with me. And the whole idea behind it is to really make people test their bullshit detectors, because, you know, episode one, one of the guys, my co-host on it, he was like, you can't pull the wool over my eyes. He's currently like got 3 out of 15 right. So it's understanding that anyone can be conned and recognizing your inability so that you're smarter in your decision making going forward.
And I'm coming on that, aren't I?
Yes, please. I can't wait. I can't wait. So exciting. I love it. I love it.
So, yeah, really great series and different podcasts and different opportunities to really be sharing the things that kind of help people to take crime out of our lives.
Yeah.
And that's no bad thing. And I wonder, with everything that you've learned and experienced and seen with your sister going through everything that she has and your parents, and how do you define courage?
Oh, that's a really big question. Do you know, I don't think that you ever necessarily understand courage until you're faced with a situation where you need to find it within yourself. You know, Emma stepped so bravely into the moments that she had. And on the podcast, I think she says there's a moment where she sat on the end of her bed after she'd been told that Andrew was not who he said he was. And she basically remembers choosing to fight. And that's courage. That is what I define as courage, is the choices that you make in those darkest moments take courage to make the right choice. And they're not always easy. Not always easy. I mean, I have had a very blessed life, so it's not something that I ever think that I have had to tap into, but I did have breast cancer about 4 years ago, and it was a very aggressive cancer. And at those moments, those are the moments that I realised how much inner strength I had. And it's when you put yourself to the test that you find yourself understanding who you are even more. So I think, yeah, I found my courage in those moments, and I've taken that forward with me, and I look at those, that test every day, and think that's why I'm doing what I'm doing now, because I've got the courage. I know that's in me now, and I know it's in Emma.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for taking us on this journey of intrigue, betrayal, and learning to move on. I really encourage people to listen to your podcast, Conning the Con, not just for the suspense, but for the sense of justice we gain in seeking out and standing for the truth. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Oh, thank you, Lou. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Take care. See you soon. Oh, see you on Fireside.
Yeah, brilliant.
Cheerio. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for showing us that even when our trust has been betrayed, we can still stand by our values and use them to set the world to rights. You can listen to Conning the Con on your favourite podcast provider and follow Sarah on Instagram at Conning the Con. Thanks to Silk Studios for producing and sourcing the guests for the show. And thanks to you all for listening. Take care, choose courage, and see you next week.